Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview with Bill Ozer. Bill is a singleton, a one-of-a-kind, a jack of many, 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 many trades, and master of each one that he tries. I know him, as you will hear me say, as a performer and a writer, a theater critic. But the story is so much more complicated, so much more interesting, and so much more eclectic than that. Although, as you will hear him say, he was singing, "Oh, What a Beautiful Morning," and "You Can't Get a Man with a Gun," off the records his parents were playing by the time he was 3, and a professional actor by the time he was 9, and had his equity card by the time he was 16, and spent perhaps the lion's share of his life in entertainment. As I said, it's only a part of the story, which is incredibly interesting. So hang on. Here come the show. Welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about being the person you really are. Not the person you're trying to be. Not the person you're aiming at. Not the person you think you're supposed to be or wish you were. Not even the person you currently think you are, but the person you really are. As a therapist, it's clear to me that many of us are acting in ways that have something to do with who we are, but quite a lot of who we are is not being demonstrated. This, of course, can be caused by getting the impression when you were a child that something about you would bring a consequence you didn't want, Something about you would bring criticism or teasing or punishment, and not bring the love, affection, and nurturing which all children need. Children are so flexible that they can begin to pretend that these qualities, whatever they are, which are bringing the consequences they don't want, actually don't exist. And so many people get so good at that, that they come into adulthood forgetting that there are things about them that they could use. So the Lynn Show is about saying, if this happened to you, well, it may not be a life sentence. It is possible to recover what you may have had to hide. And I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, because when you listen to them, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. And my interview today with Bill is screamingly appropriate to this task, because Bill is so many things, and he has allowed himself to be all the things that he is. It's a long interview. I did not want to cut any more than I had to, so I'm going to stop talking now and let you hear it from Bill. Here he is now. Okay, so I'm here with Bill Ozer, and I'm explaining to Bill that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. Now, I'm aware that there is more to Bill than I used to know. So what I know about Bill, the art to which I know Bill has given some of his life and is perhaps making some of his living, is as a theater critic and also as a performer, as a singer. Am I correct about that?
Yeah.
Yes? Okay. So would you say there's another art that, or
whole pieces of it that you don't know?
Tell me, how, if people ask you, what's the first thing, the largest definition, the one that covers the most of the things you do?
Everything.
Everything. Oh, my God. All right. Okay.
There's not much in the arts world other than visual arts that I haven't done.
I only ask one question, and it is, can you tell me when was the very first time that it occurred to you that writing or performing or acting or any of that stuff was interesting or attractive or called you? Do you know?
Before I could have ever put that into words.
Really?
My very earliest childhood memory is my grandmother's house in a part of Newton, Massachusetts, which is near Boston. And they had a Philco record player with a snake head on the tone arm. And one of the records they had was the first and last sides of the 78s of Oklahoma.
Uh-huh.
So there is no memory that I have in my head that does not include knowing the words to Oh, What a Beautiful Morning in Oklahoma.
And you were, as you say, an infant.
I was maybe three.
Three,
maybe.
Right. You were three.
And then right after that, my mother had the 78s to Annie, Get Your Gun, and I would stomp around the house singing, Oh, You Can't Get a Man with a Gun. And so I was doing show tunes practically in the womb.
Yes. And clearly your family also loved them, I mean, because they were there, right?
No more than any family did in those days.
No.
Really. My mother had done some singing on stage, but not a whole lot of it.
Okay, so right out of the gate, right, you are clearly drawn to this. And clearly, included in it, right? Okay. So, do you sing in school? Do you take singing lessons? Do they say our little boy performs?
I started piano lessons. They bought me a toy piano when I must have been maybe five or six, and I was actually banging out tunes. And so, right about that time, a lady moved next door who was a respected piano teacher, and I started taking lessons with my Aunt B.
Mm-hmm.
And I continued piano lessons pretty much all through grammar school, junior high school.
Clearly, you liked them, right? They weren't making you do it. Okay, no. So we're talking classical piano here, or?
when I switched teachers, it was more towards the pop, back towards pop. But it was classical before that, yeah.
Yeah, okay, good. Were you singing at all, in any...
9 or 10, but I also was professionally on the stage at 9, 10, and 11. I did 3 summer stock tours.
Tell me how that happened. And summer stock tours, that includes some acting?
Yeah.
So were you acting before that?
I was doing children's theater. I did children's theater for a couple of summers.
How old were you?
I think I started about 6 in children's theater.
Okay, so it's clear, really, right out of the box that this is the thing that you are drawn to. How did you wind up doing children's theater? Do you remember the plays?
Yes, there were 2 places. One was the Boston Children's Theater, and then summers going, I went to a theater at Tufts University outside of Boston, and it was called the Magic Carpet Children's Theater.
Do you remember the experience?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you liked it.
Especially liked it when somebody looking for Winthrop Peru and Music Man came through and auditioned people, and I got the part. Well, I did 1 summer stock tour, and the following year, I didn't even audition for that. And so the next year I did Oliver and Oliver, and the year after that, Dodger and Oliver. So I had done 3 summer stock tours. Those were pay.
It's a professional production.
This was totally professional production. We toured 8 cities.
And how old did you say you were?
9, 10, and 11.
9, 10, and 11.
Yep.
So it's summer, right?
Yep.
So you're out of school.
That it would have mattered. I would have skipped school for that anytime.
All right, so 9, 10, and 11, you're already a professional performer. So then what happens?
Did a community theater when it became available. And when I was 15 or so, 15 and a half, Your Good Man Charlie Brown was playing off Broadway.
Mm.
They brought a company into Boston. They thought it was going to play about 6 months or so. It ended up playing for over a year. And I auditioned. I was gung-ho. I wanted to get one of the parts. But I didn't. I was cast as the understudy for all 4 of the male parts.
Wow.
So there I was as an understudy, but they brought in New York actors, and when the New York actors cycled back to New York, there I was, ready to go. And I played all 4 of the parts at one time or another, but I did a long stint as Charlie Brown.
Oh, my.
And that's when I got my equity card.
How old were you?
I had enough points. 16.
That's amazing.
Now I knew I wanted to be an actor. I'm now in high school, and there's only one thing that I'm thinking. My life depends upon whether I do or do not get to be on Broadway.
So have you had acting classes?
Yeah, I'd had some acting classes. I had singing lessons by this point. Did have a few layers of singing lessons with a very good teacher. So I had a solid vocal technique.
Okay, so 16, we're
16.
Closing in on the end of high school.
Yep.
So what are you thinking?
I'm thinking I'm counting the days till I graduate high school. And the very next day I was on a train to New York.
Really?
Yep.
Do you know anybody in New York when you get on this train and go there?
Nope.
Do you have any money?
Yep. Not a lot.
Right.
I mean, now if I thought of how much money I had in my pocket, I think I would at least be scared.
Yeah, right.
I wasn't scared.
No.
I had maybe over $1,000 in my pocket.
Okay.
Not a lot.
So you were a big 17 years old, 18 years old, right?
I was full 18.
18. And you get off the train and what happens?
I get off the train at Penn Station and I go grab a newspaper and look for apartment for rent. Second place I looked at was a side-by-side brownstone in Greenwich Village. And the landlords lived on one side, and he wanted somebody who would help him with chores and things like that. Why he thought an actor would do that, I don't know. But he gave me the place, and it was 3 stories up and down with 4 bedrooms for $400 a month. So I had a place to stay, and I had a weekend. I looked in the trade papers. And then the following week, I did 3 auditions, cast in 2 of them. I was cast in a stock tour of Bye Bye Birdie, and then I auditioned for a year in Minneapolis, St. Paul, at the very new, at that time, Guthrie Theater. And what we were going to do is 4 musicals in the first half of the season and 4 different ones in the second half of the season. We're not talking about a week of this and a week of that. We're talking about Monday was 1 show, Tuesday another show, Wednesday, Thursday, back to the round. And
it's true rep.
True repertory.
Okay, so you arrive, you find an apartment, and you get cast.
Yep.
My God. And so then immediately you're on tour.
Of course, remember, I also had an equity card. Most
That's
of the people
right.
there don't have an equity card. And don't think that didn't matter, because it did.
I'm sure it did. And how many 18-year-olds? Very few.
Very few.
Very few, right.
So now,
and not only did you have an equity card, but you had a resume.
Yep.
you know, right, exactly. That's right.
So I do the summer stock tour, pick up the money, put the money in my pocket, go out to Minneapolis, St. Paul, find myself an apartment, just out of something out of Mary Tyler Moore. I was on the bottom floor of a Victorian with two apartments above me. It wasn't as nice as Mary's, but it was nice. And I was living there, and we did 8 musicals. And some of those musicals are shows that have stuck with me that I have done over and over again. I did not do my first Guys and Dolls. I had already done Guys and Dolls once before. But I did The Most Happy Fella first time. I did Oliver again, back in Oliver. I can remember most of the 8 shows we did. We did Guys and Dolls, we did My Fair Lady, we did Oliver, we did 2 Gilbert and Sullivan shows, Patience and the Mikado, directed by Martin Green, the famous Savoyard from Dorley Card Opera Company. We did a bunch of shows. And I learned that I was playing juveniles and character parts. Juveniles and character parts. Mostly character parts. 18 years old, I'm playing character parts.
Right, amazing.
I can't grow into them. I've already grown. So, but I realize I'm a strong singer. So we do a year in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and I come back. And, oh, by the way, in the company with me in Minneapolis, St. Paul, is a young, unknown singer-comedian whose name was Madeline Kahn. And that was the beginning of a lifelong friendship with her. Mm-hmm. Come back to New York, and the first audition I do is for Leonard Bernstein.
Wow.
He was going to do a revival of Candide, the first time it had been revived in New York. And I decided I was going to go after the tenor part of the governor. So I go out there and sing something with a high B at the end of it. Bernstein, Lenny, comes paddling down to the edge of the stage, calls me down to his ear, and he says, "You're not really a tenor, son." "Yes, I am. I just sang a B." He said, "I know what you sang, but you're not really a tenor. Go sing as a baritone." So I sang as a baritone. I got cast as a baritone in the leading baritone role.
Wow.
And during that time, Bernstein, it had a patter song, and Bernstein wanted to do it all for Cuckta Fast. And I knew enough to be deferential, and I said, "Mr. Bernstein, sir, I know you wrote this and all that, sir, but I don't think I can sing it that fast, and besides, if you sing a little slower, you'll understand the words." And I taught him. And I showed him. And that began another lifetime friendship.
Wow.
That man was probably more important to my life and who I became and who I was than anybody else.
Wow.
I will never stop missing Lenny. We did Candide together. And then, I think right around this time, I did my first actual Broadway show. I did a replacement in a musical that Angela Lansbury did called Dear World, which is based on the Mad Woman of Shiloh.
Yes.
And I took over from Milo O'Shea for the last 4 or 5 weeks of the run.
Wow.
And that was the first time I actually appeared on Broadway. And I breathed a sigh of relief. I made it. 18 months.
Okay, so it took you 18 months...
to get there?
To get to Broadway. Amazing. 18 months. You arrived at 18 years old, and it took you 18 months. You were 21 years old or 22 years old?
Not even.
Not even
20.
Oh, what am I saying? Right.
I'm 19.
You're 19.
19.
Wow.
So now I go out on the road with a couple of new shows, including one of the most ignominious flops in the history of Broadway, called Kelly. Mm. David Susskind was the producer. We played Philadelphia, not particularly successfully, came to Boston, got scathing reviews, would have been better reviews than what we got. And he closed it up after opening midweek, and he finished after the first weekend. But instead of looking at the handwriting on the wall and saying, "We're done," he took us back into New York and rehearsed us and convinced himself that we had a better show.
Wow.
And he opened it on Broadway for the one inglorious night.
Oi.
Oi. Oi. Oi. Oi. Oi. Oi. Fiddle on the Roof, it was not.
No. No.
And Bach and Harnack, it was not either. Both of those are very Jewish.
Yes, right. You're right.
Terrible show. Then I was in a show called A Time for Singing, based on How Green Was My Valley, which wasn't a bad show, but the two lead roles were badly cast. Mm. And we did get to Broadway, and we played probably 2 months on Broadway before folding. And after that show, I'm looking around for a job, and I see a musical about the Declaration of Independence.
1776.
And I said, well, I've already been in enough flops already. I said, that can't be any good. But I wasn't working, and I went and I auditioned. And I was cast. I had probably the best role I've ever had so far.
Who are you?
I was John Dickinson from Pennsylvania.
Oh, my goodness.
The one who doesn't sign.
Yeah, right.
And we're rehearsing, and we're all thinking, but no one's saying anything, that this is not as bad as it seemed like it was going to be. We go to Washington to open up, and on opening night, we play the show, and the audience leaps to its feet.
Yeah.
I mean, they're all on their feet, screaming. And we're looking at each other saying, WTF.
right.
And we're also saying, could this not be as bad as we thought it might have been? And we're all kind of thinking, it's much better than we thought it was going to be. But it's only Washington. We could still get clobbered in New York.
Yeah.
We go to New York, and we're not clobbered, and we settle down for a run. And I was with the show for 18 months again. Back in that again. For a long time. Including getting nominated for a Tony Award for Supporting Actor, which I did not win. And then I was climbing the walls. It was too long for me. And
Too long to be in a show?
In one show,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then I jumped to a Bach and Harnack show after Fit on the Roof called The Rothschilds. Hal Linden starred and won a Tony Award for it. And about that time I was doing... Oh, I'd also done several things with Stephen Sondheim, too. Replacements in his shows and stuff. I'd been around at that point. And I was back in college and I was studying music.
Wait. So you decided to go back to school?
No, I'm in college at the same time. I do everything all at once.
Oh, hold on.
I mean, I'm not 19, I'm 20, you know?
Yeah, that's right, but you didn't say anything about college.
I had gone back to college and started studying music.
Where?
Hofstra University. And I did not finish. But I was tired of the performing, active performing, and I had an opportunity to go to Italy and study at La Scala's school. Mm-hmm. And I studied opera production. And then I came back to New York. By the way, I had a long background in opera, too. I had gone to the opera when I was a kid because we had a wonderful impresario in Boston named Sarah Caldwell. And my first opera was star Joan Sutherland and Marilyn Horne.
Wow.
Yeah.
Starting at the top.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, but it was all good. I had seen 25 operas by the time I graduated high school. So I was also an opera bug, too.
No kidding.
Oh, yeah.
Did you want to sing opera?
No. Only because I couldn't.
Right.
Only because nobody in their right mind would let me sing opera.
I see. So you were studying opera production.
Opera production. Coaching and directing. Come back. Knock, knock, knock on City Opera, knock, knock, knock on the Met, knock, knock, knock on City Opera, knock, knock, knock at the Met, knock, 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 knock. Finally, the Met says, all right, come on in, we're tired of you hanging around. And so I went to work for the Met for 5 years.
Wow.
As an assistant conductor, which is a coach.
So essentially, you're helping people learn their roles, is that what it is?
Small roles.
Small roles.
Small roles.
Right.
Working with a conductor, and
it's like a musical director.
It's like working with the conductor on small pieces to help him build the big pieces. Ah. And I forged a very strong working relationship with Jim Slavine. But in my fifth year, the Met went on strike, and I wasn't unionized, and I was going with somebody who was in the orchestra and was getting unionized, but I didn't, and just seemed like a time to get out.
So I want to stop you for a second. What it sounds like you're saying is that you decided that you wanted to be on Broadway, that you wanted to be a theater performer, and then you did that. And then you sort of had been there, done that, right?
Pretty much.
Yeah, right? And so then...
Sort of.
You went to this other love of yours, which opera. Is opera. And then you did that as well.
Yep.
Right? And then...
It's not over yet.
I'm quite sure it's not over. But then this thing happened. So does that mean that you leave opera at this point?
Yeah. There were no jobs in opera for me.
Right.
Once you've worked for the Met, it's hard to get another
Yes,
job.
Right.
So I came back to New England and thinking that, you know, maybe it's time to leave the entertainment world for a while. I'm crazy. I'm young. I'm gay. I'm thinking I'd like to maybe form a relationship with
right.
somebody. Entertainment is not a place where you form lasting relationships.
Right.
At least not lover relationships. So I said, let me try something different. I came back to New England where I was born, and I found something else. I worked for a number of years in management production.
Of?
Production management. And it was a box factory.
Ah, yeah.
Owned by my uncle. But I did management for a while. At the same time, I started playing piano in bars to make money. And I forged a nice career as a sing-along piano bar pianist. But then I started getting offers to do cabaret performances, and I did cabaret performances. I'm back into it again. And then I get asked to be at the North Shore Music Theater, which is an equity theater outside of Boston, a very respected one. And the next thing I know, I turn around and I've got more performances logged at the North Shore Music Theater than anybody else ever had. I had played 26 parts in it and received an award for longevity. I was still alive and still standing. The stage hadn't collapsed under me. I did a whole bunch of shows out there. All the time while I was working different things, because after I finished manufacturing, I went to work in the human services and did 15 years in child protection, too.
Good grief.
I've done some interesting things.
Well, one of the things that's so interesting about you is your flexibility.
I'm mercurial.
Yes, you are.
Yep.
You are. And, well, I mean, you're mercurial, and also you have remarkable skill sets. I mean, you seem to be able to...
I build the skill sets as I go.
As you go. Exactly.
As I go.
Exactly.
While I was in Child Protective Services, I finally got my college degree. I'd never gotten it. And in psychology. And then immediately turned around and got a master's degree in a related field. So I'm doing all these things at the same time.
And now what are you?
I'm in my 40s now. Left the state of New Hampshire after a period of time and looking around for something different to do. And I'd always run some small businesses while I was doing this. And I said, it's time to quietly to build just a small business, support yourself and all that. And I had been with somebody at this point for about 15, 16 years. We ended up 21 years together. And I studied dog grooming.
Doggery?
Dog grooming, yep.
Oh, dog grooming.
Dog grooming, yeah. And with the idea of opening a shop, and we were not able to do it up north, and my partner turned to me and said, how about a geographic fix, meaning let's move someplace? And I said, yeah, I think it's time. And he said Florida, and I said North. I said the Carolinas. He said Florida. I said the Carolinas. He was very ill, so we ended up in Florida. And we looked all over Florida for a shop to buy. And the night I saw a shop in Bradenton, I also attended the opera and saw a favorite opera of mine, Lakme. Mm-hmm. And I thought they did a pretty good job on it. And I said, Bradenton it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I settled here. And I bought and opened a dog grooming shop. It was already an existing shop. And I ran that for a while, and that wasn't enough. Oh, by the way, my partner, we moved here in April, and that partner died on December 26th, the same year.
Oh, my.
Yep. So there I was without any real supports.
Right.
And I looked around, and while I was kind of recovering, I got a lot of calls to perform because my performing skills preceded me. And I found out that a lot of the people who book shows around here booked them on Monday for Wednesday performance. I thought that was insane myself. But that's how it was. And I did that for about a year and a half working for other people at good wages. I was getting good money. And I thought to myself, something is wrong with this. If everybody is letting people produce and they never know from one minute to the next what day the show is going to be or who's going to be performing, there's got to be a better way. And I approached a couple of the theaters that I was working at off and on, and I said, I can do this better. I will put together a whole series for you. You will know by August what nights you're going to be having shows and who's going to be performing so you can sell subscriptions. And that's exactly what we did. And I started a productions company, which grew for a while and then closed during the worst of the recession. And then it got reopened and I just sold it back 2 months ago.
Wow.
So we were doing that. I mean, I don't ever stay busy. And I started other businesses. So I had at one point three businesses juggling. Wow. At one point. I also had a senior assessments business where we assess the well-being of various seniors. And that didn't take much of my time. And I've sold other businesses. But now I'm down to grooming part-time for customers I've had for years, the senior assessments business, the entertainment business, the productions company is gone. And the people I sold it to have opened up a cabaret out in Lakewood Ranch. And I'm glad it's them, not me. Every other year I would perform for my venues, put it together, a cabaret show. But along the way, I contacted Talkin' Broadway when I discovered they were looking for a writer for Minneapolis, St. Paul, of all places. They had somebody out there and didn't have somebody out there. They thought it was a major theater center. And I just jotted a note to the people who were looking. I said, hey, you ever think of covering Southern Florida, Florida's West Coast? I said, because there's a lot of theater here. And she went back and forth, and they asked how much theater was here, and I showed them, and this, that, and the other thing. And they said, after a while, they said, yeah, we'll give you a try. Write three reviews, see how it goes. I wrote three reviews, and they said, we'd like to continue you. I said, okay. And since then, I have built my position inside the theater world, up and down the coast, all the way from Tampa, down into Punta Gorda and parts of Charlotte County. And I think that because of my professionalism, because I love this so much, I have garnered some respect. And I clearly have been involved in theater all my life, so I know what I'm looking at, and I think I have a good eye for it. That's how I built my reputation. And along the way, I've done other things. I've been asked to speak at the Oslo. I helped out in various capacities at the Sarasota Opera. You name it, I've done it.
I guess that's right.
There's nothing I wouldn't do.
No, and one of the things that's so fascinating about you is not only the mercurial nature and the building of the skill set, but you don't have any judgment about anything. Everything is okay with you. You can see the benefit or the value in all of these diverse things that you've done. Do you think that's wrong?
No, that's true. I think that fits into who I am and what I am. I am a judgmental person, and I'm not a judgmental person.
Well, wait, let me just say this. So many people in theater think of working in anything else as something you do in between, something you don't care about, something you may even not like, but you have to do, but you don't have any of that.
Well, you know what? I have never worked at a restaurant.
I see.
And I think that being the only actor to carry an actor's equity card who's never worked in a restaurant, there's something wonderful to be said about that.
I'm sure
I never
right.
waited a table.
But you've done everything else.
I've done all kinds of interesting things. Tell me what interests me. I don't, you know, if you offer me something interesting to do, I'm going to probably say yes, that sounds like fun.
Yeah.
And then worry about how the hell I'm going to fit it into my schedule. I'm a really positive person for various and sundry reasons, but I believe in positivity. I just think that you decide what you're going to do and how you're going to do it. And I would rather be upbeat and positive, because I could decide to be miserable and cranky, but I'm just not going to do that. But I respect everybody's rights to do things that are not necessarily what I would do. And when they're doing things that I'm not entirely comfortable with, because I can just do a wide range around them. But the fastest way to know that I don't care for somebody is if I don't talk about them. You toss a name out at me and you hear me listen to you talk about them for 20 minutes without saying a word, you can probably figure that Bill doesn't like them too much. But I'll never say anything bad. There's no point in saying anything bad. I'm very anal retentive and very concrete. And I have a billion little pieces that I refer back to that keep me centered. One of which is that the Second Amendment is the right to bear guns. First Amendment,
right.
Speech.
Right.
That's my favorite amendment. I've never owned a gun, I've never fired a gun, and I never will.
Right.
I don't care one way or the other about that. I love the First Amendment, because that is the amendment that gives me the right to shut my mouth. I can say nothing about anything I want to say nothing about. And I have that right. There are things I think that the world doesn't have to know what I think. It's not going to help anybody, or it's not going to be necessary for anybody but my closest friends to know what I'm thinking about.
Right.
And so I think a lot of people out there who express all kinds of opinions about things that they probably don't even know much about is just wrong. It's wrong for me. It may not be wrong for them. I don't express opinions unless I think there's something I have to contribute that's positive. So, yeah, I'm a real positive guy, and I'm mercurial, and I'm, I guess, fairly smart about the things I'm smart about and not about the things I'm not. But other than a few things I've decided I will never try, like skydiving, I already know I'm not going to skydive. I'm ready to try a lot of interesting things. I was offered a chance to work on the whole of an opera this season, and Vince called me and said, "Will you?" And I said, yes, I will. And then had more fun than any human being should be allowed to have. I had never done the whole of it. I'd just done little bits and pieces of it. Great experience. I loved it. It was fun. It was tremendous. I'm willing to do that. I have spoken at the Oslo out at the Oslo night about pre-curtain lectures. That's fun, sharing my knowledge, seeing, you know, my friends and neighbors and stuff. Yeah.
I'm interested that you said you're a concrete person. What exactly does that mean?
You ever hear of Myers-Briggs?
Yes.
Okay. I am STJ in the Myers-Briggs. Sensing, thinking, judger.
Sensing, thinking. Oh, my God.
And, of course, you can figure out that I'm extroverted.
You're extrovert, right. Cleo, I didn't need to ask that one.
So I'm ESTJ.
So, wow.
That is the lower left quadrant.
Yes.
Not only...
And solid.
Not
solid. There's nothing mitigating that.
Not only that, I am so far in the lower left quadrant that I am clawing at the grid to get out.
Oh, my God.
Right out of there. I would claw my way right out of there. Now, Myers-Briggs has been discredited strongly because it only works for maybe 20% of the population. I happen to be the 20% that it works for.
Real,
and it's really a clear definition of who and what I am.
Right.
So it does work for me, but I am just very, very how I sit, how my brain works. Now I have learned to work with people who are other, but if you go too far away from that,
it really makes you uncomfortable.
You know, perceivers are people that I really have more trouble working with. They look at something and see the whole of it and then tell you if it's not there in front of me. Now, right now, I could describe your curio cabinet
right. And
what's in it. But if you were talking to me on the phone and telling me what's in the curio cabinet, forget it. I may as well just shoot myself. I could not imagine it. I couldn't see it. I can only understand what I see.
Yes.
So people trying to describe things that I've never seen or have no sense of, I do not do interior decorating.
Right.
I don't even come close. Although I did once decorate a house with wallpaper and choose all the wallpaper, and somehow or other it ended up flowing beautifully. I don't know how that happened. That was a mistake. It's a gift from God. God's going to said, I'm going to take this poor fool and make him look good. It's to God. It's another thing. I have a very strong sense of God.
Yes.
I can tell you what's in front of me. I can see it. I can understand it. People tell me that, how do you go and write a review of something you've seen and you barely take notes? It's not even barely. I don't take notes.
Right.
I'm watching. I'm sensing things. I'll see a little detail. That's an important detail, an important piece. And I'll put it in my mind to remind myself this was important. Or I'll sense the overall concept. For example, Beatsville. I understood what they were trying for from almost the opening song. And then I thought they did a great job making it a unified whole. I happened to have seen it again last night. I either understand it or I don't understand it. Now, I occasionally have seen plays that I didn't understand. My dear friend Marie Colicuri, who you know too.
Yeah.
Marie and I went to a play last year because she will not drive up to St. Petersburg, and so she meets me and we drive. We went to see a play called Mr. Burns' Post-Electric Play. I've never in my life felt like such a dummy. And I looked at Marie after the first act. I said, "Do you understand any of that?" She says, "Not a clue." I said, "Really?" It wasn't until I actually had to go and research it with a company back in Boston that was doing the same play at the same time. And from their materials, I sort of understood it from the outside looking in. Not from looking in. I didn't understand it at all.
But not everything speaks to everybody,
no.
Right?
And I've seen things that didn't speak to me that are fine. Mm-hmm. I have declined to see Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
I actually once worked with Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Mm-hmm.
I never mentioned it. Some point along the way, after all of the crap and all the working at the Met and back, and I was back in New England, I developed a clientele as a vocal coach for Broadway performers.
Mm-hmm.
And I was working for Cameron McIntosh's organization. I coached most of the Jean Valjeans who appeared on Broadway in Les Miserables, including Alfred Bowie. Because Alfred Bowie, even though he was a well-schooled singer, this part lay low for him.
Yeah, I was talking about how open you are. And you were talking about how positive and how and a decision that you made about being positive in your life. So can you paraphrase that for me?
Yeah, and my background is some severe depression.
Mm-hmm.
Relatives and things. And I kind of inherited it myself, and I just said, that's never going to beat me. I'm going to live above that. So I don't let the fact that I don't let myself get down, not when I can be happy. I wake up every morning, and I have made a choice to be happy, and then it's very easy to just ride that. First thing I do when I wake up in the morning is check me, check my partner, check the 5 dogs between us, and if I can check off 7 of those things, it's going to be a great day. Nothing can beat the heck out of that day, as long as we're all okay. And then can only get better from there.
Yeah, it's a wonderful message, because I think that most people feel that they're at the mercy of things, not that they can take control of it, that they can make it different, that they can make a choice. And clearly you have, and also, you just keep choosing. You choose joy.
I choose joy. I choose happiness. People don't look at the things that happen to them and realize and go out of their way to see the happiness of it. I thank God. Every year, after the theater season ends and a new one's beginning, I write a column about the various things I've seen that were particularly memorable, and hats off to them. I do not choose one over the other. I choose series of what was good. And then at the end of it, I thank all the theaters locally who have hosted me, because I get all my tickets for free, mm-hmm. and the Talking Broadway for continuing to let me write for them. What's not to be grateful? I mean, I have an endless stream of free theater tickets in front of me. How many people out there would like to have that?
No, and you know, I think you're making another really good point, that it's easier to be positive when you're grateful. You know, when you actually see the good in your life and you have gratitude, it's much easier to be positive and to resist what might not be so perfect.
Yeah. I have another one of those little stupid things that we were talking about. I think it was off the radar, about little things that guide me. Flip a coin. Mm-hmm. It lands on heads. It's not tails. Lands on tails. It's not heads. Nobody can have everything. So with that in mind, it's impossible to have everything. You may as well realize that you can try and have as much of what you'd like as you possibly can and as little of what you don't want. But nobody can have it all. So why be upset over what you don't have? You just have to, you know, realistically. I never ever get to watch television. I've never seen Game of Thrones. I've seen bits and pieces of The Sopranos. I've never seen, Mad Men. I've never seen Mad Men. Never seen that one episode of it. And everyone tells me, oh, it's the greatest thing ever written. Never seen any of it. And I probably never will, because I'm at the theater 2 and 3 times a week. Who the heck has time to sit in front of my television set? But that's a choice I've made, and I'm happy with it.
Yes, yes. And that point, that to appreciate what you have.
Absolutely.
And not to bewail what you don't have. I love it. Okay, I have one other question that I like to ask. It's difficult with you. You probably know that most people have more of a through line in their life, that most people are not nearly as flexible, nearly as open, not nearly as eclectic as you are. So I usually ask, you know, having spent a life doing this or that, right, what, you know, what would you say about it? So for you, it's really a question of what would you say about living this really extraordinary life, this life that that defies the conventional wisdom, seeming to be that people settle into a thing, maybe they do two things, or maybe they do things that are similar, right? But you are not...
That was a week in my life.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Exactly, right?
I would say that, number one, God has been extraordinarily good to me. There are things that I have not revealed that are even more so. God has been very good to me when the bad times hit and the things were tough. God helped me. And God helps me every single day. That's what I'd say, number one. Number two is that I have arrived at a place that I really like. My late 50s and 60s have been just great, because I am having more opportunities that are fun than any human being ought to have had a chance to have in a lifetime, let alone just a short period of time. I am so grateful for all the really fun things I've had to do. That's what I'd say.
And that is a perfect place to stop. Thank you so much, Bill.
My pleasure.
So, as always, it is my hope that when you listen to someone like Bill, you are saying to yourself, is this how I feel about my life? Am I allowing myself to be everything that occurs to me, everything that takes my fancy? Am I pursuing those things that feel integral to me, essential to me? Well, if the answer is yes, yippee for you. If the answer is no, please know that it is not too late to recover some of what you may have had to hide in your childhood. And if you want to talk to me about that, you can find me at my website. That is thelynnshow.com. T-H-E-L-Y-N-N-E. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. Thelynnshow.com. Well, we're going to go out on the song that Bill sang in 1776, Conservative Men. This is from the cast album. And as always, I hope you got something that you can use from this show, something that inspired you, or something that'll bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station. And as always, I sure hope you will be too. So now, here is Conservative Men.
Oh, say, do you see what I see? Congress sitting here in sweet serenity. I could cheer, the reason's clear. For the first time in a year, Adams isn't here. And look, the sun is in the sky. A breeze is blowing by, and there's not a single fly. I sing Hosanna, Hosanna,
Hosanna, Hosanna.
And it's cool. Come ye cool, cool conservative men. Our like may never ever be seen again. We have land, cash in hand, self-command, future planned. Fortune thrives, society survives in neatly ordered lives with well-endowed wives. Come sing Hosanna, Hosanna. In our breeding and our manner, we are cool. Come ye cool, cool, considerate set. We'll dance together to the same minuet. To the right, ever to the right, never to the left, forever to the right. Let our creed be never to exceed regulated speed, no matter what the need. Come sing Hosanna, Hosanna. Emblazoned on our banner is keep cool. What we do rationally. We never ever go off half-cocked, not we.
Why begin till we know that we can win?
And if we cannot win, why bother to begin?
We say this game's not of our choosing. Why should we risk losing?
We cool men.
Mr. Hancock, you're a man of property, one of us. Why don't you join us in our minuet? Why do you persist on dancing with Mr. Adams? Good Lord, sir, you don't even like him.
That is true. He annoys me quite a lot. But still, I'd rather trot to Mr. Adams' new gavotte.
But why, sir? For personal glory, for a place in history? Be careful, sir. History will brand Mr. Adams and his followers as traitors.
Traitors, Mr. Dickinson? To what? British crown or the British half-crown? Fortunately, there are not enough men of property in America to dictate policy.
Perhaps not. But don't forget that most men with nothing would rather protect the possibility of becoming rich than face the reality of being poor. And that is why they will follow us.
To the right, ever to the right.
We say this case.
getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go. My shot, my time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. Singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have got